It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, food for thought. Say we go out for brunch. You want bacon and sausage. I go for the tofu scramble. You order a decaf mochaccino soy latte. I don't know what that is. Taste can seem so incredibly individual, as though no two people could possibly share all the same likes and dislikes. But beyond individual taste buds, there are vast social and economic trends and even hidden tastemakers shaping the foods we eat. Like cupcakes. Remember how they used to come in two flavors, chocolate or vanilla, and they were served at children's birthday parties? And then, almost overnight, they were transformed into upscale, decadent desserts for grown-ups. How does that happen? Journalist David Sachs investigates in his book, The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. Sarah Nix caught up with him.
It seems like over the past 10 years, food has become the next great mark of cultural savvy. Do you have any idea why knowing about the next big food trend or the latest hot chef or the best fermentation recipe has become equivalent to, say, being in the loop about music or art or films?
Yeah. You know, my wife loves to say that food is our new culture, that chefs are our rock stars and our artists, and that's how we value things today. And I think it's for a couple reasons. One is that food and cooking went really since the mid-90s and the rise of the Food Network and became a form of entertainment. And I think it grew because it is accessible to everyone. You know, opera is something that's accessible to only people who really understand it and live in an area where there's opera and can kind of afford to go. Art is the same thing. You know, there's not a lot of art shows that people go to. It's not sort of the most accessible form of culture to the masses. And the other forms of culture have been kind of devalued, right? Music is now something you just get whenever you want, however you want. And there's no real challenge to it. You just download billions of songs at the touch of a finger. Same with film and television and movies. But, you know, food still requires an effort. You have to go and pay an amount of money to get it. You can't just click and get it for free. It's an analog form of culture and remains so. You can't digitize food. So you could talk about it and share it virally, but it's still a very human experience. And because of that, you know, everybody has access to it in some way, whether it's people talking about cupcakes and sharing recipes about them or someone going to Alinea or some really fancy restaurant in Chicago and paying $300 for dinner and discussing that and posting photos of it and, you know, critiques of it on Yelp or whatever.
It's fascinating to me how sticky these trends are, these fads are. You know, I heard a couple of years ago about this bone luge thing where you scoop the marrow out of a roasted beef shank bone and then you pour port. You drink the port from the scooped out bone. And it seemed completely absurd. But of course, I went and did it anyhow. I mean, why do you think they're so attractive sometimes, these trends?
I mean, the ones that are attractive and the ones that have sort of staying power do so because they're good. They taste good, or like the bone luge, they're fun. You know, I think there's something to be said about the benefits that these things give. You know, the fact is, like, the food truck trend, which isn't a food but sort of a business model that in itself is a food trend, it hasn't just flashed in the pan and gone away because it provides a benefit for people opening food trucks that opening a restaurant doesn't. It's less expensive. It's mobile. They can test out new concepts. They're not tied down to a lease. They're not tied down to a brick and mortar location. And then for people dining there, you know, the food comes to them. There's a sense of excitement and conspicuous consumption, but there's also, it's a quicker, easier option to get lunch when you work in an office in a certain area than having to go and drive to a restaurant and sit down. And that advantage is kind of built into it. And that is the case for almost all food trends that tend to be sort of longer lasting ones rather than fads of the season.
You know, it's fascinating to me. There are clearly these fads that, like the bone luge, come out of nowhere and seem kind of ridiculous, but have a short lifespan. Others stick for a really long time. And some that seem really obvious never take off. Like, your chapter about Indian food was fascinating.
Yeah. Trends can kind of be on the uptick for a long period of time. And only when the conditions are right do they really emerge and grow into something that's national or international. Indian food's a great example. There have been people that have been trying to make it into sort of a national food trend, something like Mexican food in the way that it's really just a part of our diet, or Chinese food, for the better part of half a century. And people in the food business have been betting on this and predicting it and saying, you know, 1984 is going to be the year of Indian food, and it hasn't happened yet. It requires a combination of different factors, from, you know, immigration rates to cultural factors, like, are there movies about India? Are people traveling to India? Do we know the names of Indian movie stars or Indian American movie stars? Are there these cultural figures or foods that we're familiar with? Are there foods from other cultures, like sriracha hot sauce and Thai food, which are close enough that they can kind of serve as an entry point to something like Indian food? All these need to be in place, and something needs to happen for them to sort of burst onto the scene.
You know, I was really struck when I was reading your book about the effort that goes into influencing our food preferences, essentially. Is it all an exercise, do you think, in opening up new markets and getting us to spend more of our disposable income on boutique foods? Or is there some kind of conversation that we need to have about whether it's socially responsible, when people are going hungry in this country, to obsess over heirloom wheat or artisanal sausages?
It's a good point. I mean, there's that fundamental question of why should we care about this, right? Why should anyone care about food trend when there are people in the country and in our own communities who are hungry? And I think you need to look at it in another couple of ways, is that, you know, food trends are the innovative edge of the economy, and they touch everyone. It's not just wealthy people who are eating at very fancy restaurants. It's everybody who works down the line of the food industry, which is one of the biggest industries in the country, that employs people from, you know, the six-figure salaries to working wage jobs. And so with each new innovation, with each new trend, you're getting more money that's going into the pockets of those people that will then be able to feed their families. As well, these trends can have the impact of improving the food and the offerings that people who are struggling to feed themselves face. You know, the rise of the past number of years of community gardens, community-supported agriculture, organic farming is in its way its own food trend, right? As the people who are trendy foodies in these different cities pick up on that and talk about the need to, you know, be local and support community gardening, money has flowed in that direction and assisted people in those communities with that.
So do you think that there's a way in which some food trends, maybe particularly the health-oriented food trends, have potential to improve the quality of nutrition that people are getting who maybe don't have huge disposable income?
I think so. I mean, I think these things trickle down. When you think about something like organics a number of years ago was, you know, a very fringe kind of agricultural movement, and you could get organic meat and produce in crunchy smelling health food stores scented like raw almonds and patchouli. Today, you can get that stuff at Walmart. You can buy organic produce at Walmart. You can get it at Costco, and it is less expensive because the market for it has grown, and so it becomes accessible to more people. And as more people talk about food, that becomes not just something for wealthy urban foodies. It becomes something that ordinary people talk about as well in their own communities. And so they demand better quality food in school lunches and in college cafeterias and as part of, you know, food stamp programs, where now people are saying, well, let us spend some of that money at CSAs. Why can't we spend our food stamps at CSAs? So I do think fundamentally it's beneficial. I don't think it's a let them eat cake kind of scenario where, you know, people are talking about cronuts and Instagramming it while, you know, the world goes hungry. I don't think it's that much of a either or.
You know, someone told me last year that he thought that food had jumped the shark, that we'd become so precious and obsessed with eating the right things and putting it up on Instagram that we'd essentially forgotten that in the end, it's food, it's nutrition. But you defend these trends. Why do you do that?
Well, listen, in the end, you know, he's partly right, your friend. In the end, it is food, nutrition, and it all ends up, you know, in the same place, to put it delicately. And yet it is tremendously important, I think. You know, food is more than just fuel. It is the way we express our culture. It is the way that we socialize. It is the way that we turn our family recipes and our identities into viable business models that employ thousands of people, whether it's, you know, a product line of snack cakes or whether it is a restaurant chain that somebody starts in their city and then grows nationwide. Food is a tremendous part of our expenditure and our income, you know, anywhere from 10% if you're quite wealthy to 30 to 40 to 50% of your paycheck. And so because it is, and because so much energy is going into it, it is something of tremendous importance. And because of that importance, where we put that money, how we spend it, how we expend our time and treasure and energy in acquiring and cooking and eating food is tremendously important. It says everything about who we are and where we live to what our social and cultural and political values are. You know, how you eat is who you are.
Well, thanks so much, David. I really appreciate your talking with us.
My pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
David Sachs is the author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. He talked with Sarah Nix. When it comes to food, everyone has an opinion. That's what producer Raymond Tangakar discovered during a recent visit to Chicago's Windy City Rib Fest, where he asked folks what they look for in food.
My name is Shelley Efrosinis. I live here in Chicago. When it comes to food, I look for fresh, interesting, and quality, high quality. Well, quality is important to me because especially if you're eating at a street festival, if it's not high quality, you're going to get really sick. I experience that. Actually, for fruits and vegetables, I think about organic all the time. I shop at grocery stores that carry organic as much as possible. And with meat, it's important that it's hormone-free and treated humanely.
My name is Jay. I live in Old Town, Chicago. What I look for, in any meal, really, is first flavor. I have the fortune of having a pretty nice metabolism, which is great. But spice is very important to me. I try to use that, incorporate that pepper or any kind of spice and flavoring to anything I eat. But definitely healthy is probably the second piece of that. Try to stay healthy and fit. So when I cook, I try to incorporate the use of anything, really, from sage and basil all the way to paprika and some really hot red pepper blends that I make. And so I use that with just about any seafood, any poultry, any pork. I do ribs occasionally and incorporate that spiciness to the flavor of the food. And in addition to that, vegetables, any kind of potato mix, and a lot of different things that I make even for breakfast, frankly, with eggs. A lot of different spice to each thing, each meal.
My name is Don Gibson. I live in Chicago, Illinois. I grew up in central Illinois. I look for variety, actually. So a lot of times when we're going out to eat, we try to try something new, different. We're always looking for something, you know, maybe something that we're familiar with, but that's got a different twist.
One second, please.
Hi, my name is Keith McCormick. I'm the executive director of the Uptown Chamber of Commerce. I think it's really important to try new things because life is too short to eat boring food. Food is a great gateway to bring people from different cultural backgrounds together. And I think it's always been that way. You know, we sit down at a table and we share a meal. I get to learn something about you and where you're from. And I think it's a great opportunity.
That was Shelley Efrosinis, Jay Nolan, Don Gibson, and Keith McCormick at the Windy City Rib Fest in Chicago. What do you look for in food? Drop us a note on our Facebook page. Coming up, Julia Child was right. We'll remember the TV chef who told America to eat everything in moderation and with plenty of lovely butter. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. When it comes to food, perhaps no other chef did more to change the way Americans cook and eat than Julia Child. Her groundbreaking cookbook, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, introduced us to everything from basic knife skills to boeuf bourguignon. The legendary editor who brought that book to market was Judith Jones, and she reflects on their friendship in her own memoir, The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. She told Steve Paulson, it's hard to convey just how different American attitudes toward food were before Julia.
It certainly was a very different time.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps more than anybody, Julia Child awakened these repressed appetites, because it was too long we'd had this sort of Puritan heritage where food was fodder, and that was that. And about the time I came into the world, gastronomic America was at its lowest point. And what happened after the war, of course, was that not only had the GIs traveled and brought back an appetite for more interesting tastes, but every little secretary was suddenly going to Paris for the first time. It was no longer just for the elite.
Well, you were one of those people who went off to France at an early age. I mean, you went there after college, and my sense is you really discovered the glory of French cooking at that time.
I did, yeah. I was supposed to go for a two-week vacation, and I stayed 3.5 years. Fortunately, my purse was stolen when I was sitting in the Tuileries Gardens and thinking, how am I going to leave this beautiful city? And I just belong here.
And the purse had your return ticket in it as well.
It had everything, my passport, return ticket, traveler's checks, my whole identity. But instead of sort of boohooing and saying, send me some money to come home, I just went out and started looking for a job. And decided that it was fate.
Hmm. Now, what was it about the French and food that was so special, that was so different from the environment you grew up in?
Well, for one thing, they shopped 2 or 3 times a day, and they loved it. I can remember one particular time I was standing in the boulangerie, the bread shop. We always got our bread fresh every morning. And there was a man in front of me, and he opened up the baguette, and he cheered, and then he passed the bread around to, there were a lot of people waiting in line, and they all, the cheer just rose higher and higher, and I thought, what is this about? And I asked somebody, and they said, the flour is white. We haven't had white flour since before the war. You would just never have found that in America, that joy in something, that pride, that pure love of food. It was captivating. I just fell for it.
And there were all the specialty shops. I mean, there was the butcher and the baker and the fish shop, yeah, and the cheese store and the wine merchant.
And the charcuterie and the fromagerie. And, yep. You spent a good deal of time shopping. And I think I got to know the French in that way.
Well, and it's worth pointing out that you met your own husband when you were in France. I mean, he was an American, but happened to be over
there. He was an American. And he was discovering food in much the same way. So it was very much a shared thing. And when we came back, we wanted to continue it. But we found it hard because you couldn't find in a supermarket or even a vegetable market things like leeks and shallots and all those things we just take for granted today. Fresh herbs were unheard of, and it was mostly iceberg lettuce. And so it was frustrating. And I also realized how much I didn't know. I had learned a lot from asking people, but I didn't know the techniques of cooking, the finesse, the things that make the big difference between just a good dish and that, as Julia would say, soigner.
Hmm. It seems to me that we can almost date the year when American culture came to love food. I mean, when French
yes.
cuisine went mainstream in America, and it was 1961 mm-hmm. when Julia mm-hmm. Child and her
yep.
her two French co-authors came out
yep.
with this massive book, Mastering the Art
yep.
of French Cooking.
That's
and,
right.
and you played a pivotal role in getting that book published.
Well, somebody else might have done it, but I felt that I was just the right person. We had such sort of parallel careers, Julia and I, because we were in France at the same time. We both fell in love with cooking. It was a kind of rebellion against our families. I mean, and so it was a natural coming together.
Now, it's so fascinating reading about the whole process of getting that book published, because it wasn't as if you were just the editor who came across this great manuscript and there it was, voila, you had the book. I mean, you actually tried a lot of her recipes in your own kitchen. You read, for instance, about making boeuf bourguignon and, you know, seeing what that was like.
And the difference between Julia's instructions, she told you what meat to buy. She told you to use butter plus a little oil because the butter would burn. She told you to dry the meat because you can't brown something if it dries. You mustn't crowd the pan or it steams. Once you learn it, it's part of you. You apply it the next time.
Now, it seems that a lot of the success of that book had to do with Julia Child herself, especially once she got on television, which happened
fairly
soon.
Once she got on television, it was a miracle because I don't think there's been anyone like her since. She was totally natural, unscripted. The wonderful remarks she made just came from the gut. And when she picked up the chicken and slapped it and somebody said, "Why do you massage the butter into the chicken?" She'd say, "Well, I think it likes it." And there were so many things like that that just popped out of her mouth. As I say, I think it released something that had been long repressed in people. And that is that food is fun, it's sensuous, it's creative, it's generous. I mean, you're doing it for friends and family. Enjoy it. That was just unheard of.
Now, you came to know Julia Child very well. What was she like?
Oh, she was great fun to be with. I remember once we were visiting in France for Christmas, and I went over to her house to help with the Christmas dinner, and she had a goose. But the important thing, she said, is that the feet are on that goose. I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because you want to get the tendons out, because that's what makes the legs tough." And then she took a huge knife or whatever it was and whacked the ankles and put her finger in around the tendon. Then she threw the goose on the floor with a broomstick, and then she pulled, and the whole tendon came out. And she said, "Just like pulling out the cork out of a bottle of wine." So it was just wonderful.
Now, later, you became the editor of a number of renowned cookbook writers. Claudia Roden, who wrote the classic book of Middle Eastern food. Madhur Jaffrey, who put Indian food on the map in America, and many others as well. Did these various cookbook authors have anything in common?
They did. And I made this discovery that one of the qualities that was so important is that feeling of love for this food. And they were all displaced people. Claudia grew up in Cairo and they had to leave. But she longed for the food of her childhood. That brought back her family and memories. And there was always this feeling of the recipe had that story, that history behind it, and that emotional attachment, which I think is very important. And they were also very good writers because they had to learn from scratch, just as you and I have to learn from scratch. So they understood the home cook to tell you what to anticipate and how to correct the seasonings and things like that. I found that they were really our best teachers.
And they weren't professional chefs. I mean,
they
were amateur cooks in a way.
Yeah. You see, I think the professional chef lives in a whole different world. I know he does. His challenge is to do something dramatic, surprising. He gives us ideas, of course. I mean, I love to go to a restaurant sometimes just to taste something that you want to try to emulate later at home. That isn't home cooking. Home cooking is more a rhythm through the whole week, how you're going to use dishes again. And for the individual, it's really more challenging and creative.
Now, today, you are in your 80s. Your husband passed away some years back. Do you still do much cooking yourself?
Oh, I did. And I thought at first that I would find that difficult. But it was quite the opposite. I found instead that when I came home in the evening after a day at work, tired, that the one thing I wanted to do was to roll up my sleeves and see what was in the fridge, improvise a bit, and smash the garlic. Then when it's all ready, I love to put it nicely on a plate. I light the candles. I maybe turn on some music. And when I sit down, I'm really not alone. I'm with the past, in a sense, and I'm honoring something that was very important in both of our lives.
Judith Jones was an editor at Knopf for more than 50 years. Her memoir is called The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. Steve Paulson talked with her. You know, sometimes food can seem like a high school popularity contest. There are the cool kids. These days, anything that's dark green, leafy, organic, free range. And there are the deeply uncool pariahs, the chemically processed, the sugar-saturated, the glutens. There's nutritional science behind all of this, but we're not always as rational about our food choices as we like to think. In his book, The Gluten Lie, Alan Levinovitz argues that food has become a modern religion, complete with commandments, prohibitions, and gospel truths. And the interesting thing is that he's not a nutritional scientist. He's a scholar of Chinese religion.
One of the things I think a lot of us are familiar with is the rhetoric of religion surrounding food. So you'll hear people say things like, well, this is sinfully delicious, or this is a guilty pleasure. And myself, as a scholar of Chinese religion, I also am familiar with religious diets. You know, Taoist monks had used these diets for many hundreds of years that made very similar promises to fad diets today. So these Taoist monks 2,000 years ago were saying, well, if you avoid grains and you eat our special proprietary supplements of milk thistle and mercury, you'll be immortal, you'll avoid disease, your skin will clear up, you'll be able to fly. And so I thought to myself, well, if there's all this religious rhetoric surrounding food, you hear people saying things like, why is my friend proselytizing their diet? Why do they seem so evangelical about the paleo diet? I said, well, maybe if I look at the history of food fads and fears through the lens of a religion scholar, I might be able to uncover some of the reasons that these fads keep occurring and why they're so powerful.
So let me break this down a bit. Are you making the case then that we approach food in part through a religious lens, that is, that religious patterns of thought, you know, dividing the world into good and evil, virtuous and sinning, that those habits of thought inform our food choices?
That's absolutely right. That's exactly what I'm saying. So it's not that all of our dietary rules are structured by religion and we can't trust anything about nutrition whatsoever. It's that we need to be very careful to recognize when certain kinds of biases or narratives or myths are shaping our understanding of food and what it is that we ought to eat and ought not to eat.
So we're very judgmental about food and equate some foods with virtue and some foods with vice, of course. But you suggested that it's not just that Coca-Cola, for instance, is full of bad chemicals and it's fattening and it's full of caffeine versus this nice apple is good for you. It's more complicated than that because the apple is natural.
That's absolutely right. So when I looked at the history of various food fads and fears, one of the myths that I encountered again and again was this idea of a benevolent nature that is looking out for us. So natural things are good, unnatural things are bad. And I see this manifesting itself again and again over and against the science, for instance, with things like GMOs. And I know there's going to be listeners right now that are just thinking to themselves, this guy is evil. He must be in the pocket of Monsanto. But what I want to tell them is, well, hold on one moment and think, maybe the speed with which people jump to reject evidence that goes against their understanding of food has to do in part with the fact that we tend to be more dogmatic about food, and we tend to construct narratives of good and evil and natural and unnatural. We're more dogmatic there than we are in almost any other scientific arena. Hmm. And that's something I think is really important for people to keep in mind, at least to try to open their minds to the idea that might be at play in their own beliefs about what is good to eat and what isn't.
So, for example, you tell this fascinating history going way back, the history of sugar, and you said from the first time it showed up in Europe in, what, the 17th century, I think people were convinced from the beginning that there was something evil about it.
Absolutely. Well, so one, it was a foreign thing, and they thought it was unnatural. So you had it coming in originally from the Middle East, but it didn't appear as something you would have in food until the 1600s, and you really didn't get it in bulk quantities until the 1700s, where it was being used to sweeten coffee and tea. And so what happened was these scared Puritans attributed hypersexuality and scurvy to sugar.
Hypersexuality?
Yes, believe it or not. So that's the thing they were scared of, right? You know, kids and women shouldn't be too sexual. So while sugar is pleasurable, it must make sense scientifically that sugar causes people, you know, women to sleep around and children to engage in what they call quite demurely the solitary vice. And as we move forward in time, you get to the temperance movement. People were calling sugar a gateway drug to alcoholism. And so to me, you know, this is not, it doesn't mean that 10 years from now we won't have conclusive scientific evidence that sugar is indeed like cocaine and giving your child a slice of birthday cake is like giving him a shot of bourbon. That may be the case 10 years from now. Somehow I doubt it. But we ought to be cautious given our history of irrationality with sugar. We just ought to be cautious and with gun jumping on food in general.
As somebody who tries to eat healthfully, you know, I've watched food fads come and go, and it's maddening to try to keep up. You know, for a while, you're supposed to lower your cholesterol and not eat too much fat. Now it turns out, actually, you want to make sure you're getting enough fat. You know, same thing with sugar, carbs, whatever. What I don't understand is why can't nutritional scientists seem to make up their minds and keep them made up?
That frustrated me as well. And when I asked nutrition scientists about this, they complained to me that it wasn't them that was the changing their minds all the time. It was that people want to report on very tentative science as if it is fact. Science produces more evidence. And the problem with nutrition science is that the government and diet gurus are delighted to take very tentative science and turn it into dietary commandments.
What I don't understand is it sounds like food commandments have actually been part of religion, a lot of different religions, going way, way back. What's the historic link between food and religion?
People used to think, in the late 1800s, they used to think that these dietary commandments were some kind of proto-science. And so people thought, oh, kosher laws are about not eating pork because pork has trichinosis, or not eating shellfish because shellfish can make you diseased. But Mary Douglas, a prominent anthropologist, disproved that, and she showed that, in fact, kosher laws, for example, are about dividing animals that are easily categorized, so animals that fly, for example, or animals that are in the ocean, dividing those from animals that are not easily categorized. So when kosher law says, for example, don't eat fish that don't have scales, it's not because fish that don't have scales are bad for you. It's not some kind of proto-science. It's because fish that don't have scales are weird.
What you mean? So don't eat shark or dolphin because there's something kind of strange about
them. Absolutely right. And we don't want to eat strange things because we want to have good definitions. And we think you are what you eat, right? You don't want to eat a strange creature that isn't classifiable because we don't want to become weird.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that one thing both religion and food have in common is that there's a lot of fear at the basis of both of them. And both of them are habits of mind that help us deal with or make us feel more in control of fear.
I'm really glad you brought up fear, Anne, because one of the things I noticed from reading these diet books is they open by terrifying the reader. So they list every single chronic illness that you can be scared of, and then they pathologize you. So there'll be a little questionnaire that says something like, have you ever felt tired? have you ever felt sad? You know, and so the recipe is to create a world of terrifying dietary demons to make a person feel like they need to be saved, and then to provide them with that exclusive salvific recipe.
Wow, it really is the structure of religion, isn't it? First, you're a sinner, then you find salvation and see the light, and then you must become proselytizer.
Exactly. And the thing that frustrates me so much as a scholar of religion is that religion itself is so wonderful and deep and complicated. And it answers so many important questions like how we ought, you know, or tries to answer them at least, reflects on how we ought to treat other people. What is it that happens after we die? Where did everything in the universe come from? And there's something, for me at least, about seeing religion, people's religion, reduced to a calculus about what will help them lose weight and live longer and avoid disease. That to me seems a little bit tragic. There's these great philosophers, Horkheimer and Adorno, and they bemoan the fact that people reduce food to calories and the walk to exercise. And I think that's just a wonderful line because to me, there's so much more to food than its nutritional content and the number of calories that are in it. And the fact that there are people out there who have to turn a walk into exercise in order to enjoy it, I think that's really sad. And it is a bad kind of faith.
Yeah, but to push back, I mean, I imagine there are plenty of people who would say to you, but regarding my daily walk as a form of exercise increases my pleasure, you know, or feeling that I'm eating really healthfully and choosing foods that are all organically raised and that don't have processed chemicals or sugars in them increases my pleasure in eating. So what's wrong with that?
I think you're right. You know, to a certain extent, individuals ought to do whatever they want. If it makes you feel better to eat a Chipotle now that they've eliminated GMOs, I guess in a sense that's fine. My concern, and I talk about this in the book, is that it's not individuals who suffer most from these kinds of beliefs. It's the fact that society at large becomes scientifically illiterate. So with GMOs at Chipotle, for example, most people don't actually go out of their way to think about the scientific evidence on GMOs. They demonize GMO foods. And consequently, they end up not thinking about things, for example, like the fact that Chipotle's soybean oil might be genetically modified or that the corn syrup that Chipotle uses in all of its soda is still genetically modified or that perhaps genetically modified organisms aren't the problem with our culinary culture. And perhaps the problem with our culinary culture is that people don't have time to cook. And people don't have resources to cook and don't know how to cook, or that companies are just marketing high-calorie foods to children, right? What ends up happening is individuals' dietary faiths get in the way of thinking in an evidence-based manner about what food is and how public policy ought to proceed.
Alan Levinovitz is the author of The Gluten Lie and Other Myths About What You Eat. We're going to take a quick break now, but coming up, the backstory to one of the largest national security breaches in American history. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Michelle Wilgen, and I am the author of several novels, most recently Bread and Butter, and also the co-founder of the Madison Writers Studio. A book that is one of my favorites that I return to over and over again is Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety, which follows the fortunes of two couples, Larry and Sally, and also Sid and Charity. And they first meet when they both come to Madison, Wisconsin to be professors at UW in the 30s. And then the novel follows them through the next, I think, maybe 30 years of their lives. It's really about the kind of transformative effect that another couple can have on you. It's also a little bit complicated, too. And I think the thing that I love most about it is that Charity, of Sid and Charity, is one of these people who demands a great deal from everyone around her. And she also is incredibly warm and incredibly generous and incredibly giving. And she really provides Larry with the space to be a writer. And she helps him tremendously in becoming who he later is. But that same kind of energy and attention and demands can be kind of toxic when it comes to her marriage. And so it's a very complicated sort of love story between the four of them, watching what happens from when they are young and hopeful and uncertain to what life sort of throws at them and how different they may be only maybe 300 pages later. Stegner manages to create this feeling that you have seen everything their lives had to give, when in fact it's actually a fairly compact novel. I just keep coming back to it. And actually right now I'm working on a novel about two couples, and I think it's because I just can't get that dynamic out of my head. I find it so interesting. This is the crazy thing, because he is probably best known for the novel Angle of Repose, which I've only read part of. And for somebody who wrote one of my all-time favorite novels, a novel I've probably read at least a half a dozen times, I have not read anything else by Wallace Stegner. And I think it's that feeling that you sometimes have when it's sort of like this singular experience with a writer, and you almost don't feel the need to go beyond it. You just keep going back to it. There's a scene later on in the novel, and it's already been so well established that in the marriage of Sid and Charity, Sid is sort of the one who always takes a back seat, and he kind of does what Charity tells him to do in so many ways, and it actually drives Larry a little bit crazy to observe. But they've gone on a camping trip, the two couples have, and there's an early morning moment when Larry gets up, and unbeknownst to Sid and Charity, Larry sees them walking along, I think picking berries or something. They're both naked, and it's out in nature, and it's clear that they have just had quite a night. And what is so most fascinating about it is that the role reversal that Larry perceives. He sees that at least in some moments, Sid is very much the sort of man in charge, and Charity is very much sort of almost docile. And it's so unexpected. Too intimate, really. A friend doesn't necessarily want to see their friends in that kind of moment, but it's absolutely wonderful, and it kind of hinges the entire novel. Everything sort of becomes a little bit different in your head after that moment.
Michelle Wilgen recommends Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner. And you can find more bookmarks plus an interview with Wilgen on our website at ttbook.org. And on to another couple, a pair of whistleblowers who uncovered one of the largest domestic surveillance programs in American history. To tell this story, we have to go back to 1971, Media, Pennsylvania. A tiny group of Vietnam protesters, including Bonnie and John Raines, broke into their local FBI office and stole a cache of top-secret documents. Among them were the notorious COINTELPRO papers. These were papers that revealed that the FBI had illegally spied on American citizens, had waged a campaign to discredit activists like Martin Luther King Jr. and Cesar Chavez, and had been involved in the assassination of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton. Now, 40 years later, Bonnie and John Raines have come forward to tell their own story of what happened in a documentary called 1971. It just premiered on PBS, and it's now available for streaming. Charles Monroe Kane caught up with them.
Bonnie, take me back to the night of March 8th, 1971. What was it like?
Well, we had selected that night for a very specific reason, and it was because there was a major championship boxing match that night at Madison Square Garden between Frazier and Ali. And we figured that most everybody would be listening to that fight and maybe not being as vigilant about activities going on around them where the FBI office was. So we gathered in a nearby motel room and went over our final plans and then took our assignments that night. And some of us had specific assignments outside, and then there were four who were designated to go into the offices.
John, what was going through your mind when you got there?
Terror. Especially as the night wound on far beyond what we thought the time frame was. Now, my job was to wait in a parking lot in Swarthmore College, which is right close by Media, and to be the car that would pick up the bags from the getaway car and then transfer those bags out to the house where we would sort the files.
Bonnie, you had a very specific role as well, one that I hadn't realized till recently, almost got you in a lot of trouble. You cased the joint ahead of time, right? Can
yes.
you tell us about that?
Well, we had done a very, very thorough casing about everything in the exterior environment, including the police patrols around the building. But we needed to be able to get into the offices during the day to try to see if there were any security measures, whether the file cabinets were locked or not, and to try to get a better idea about what was inside. So I was designated to call and say that I was a Swarthmore College student doing research on opportunities for women in the FBI, and I wondered if I could come in and interview the head of the office. And they were very cordial, and they brought me in, and I had enough time there to look at what I needed to look at and learn what I needed to learn. And they were not suspicious at all, even though I never took my gloves off the whole time I was taking notes in my little notebook.
You were aware, I'm sure, at the time that impersonating in front of a FBI agent, breaking into an FBI office, stealing FBI documents, you could go to jail for the rest of your life for that. And in Hoover's world, for some of the stuff that you stole, you could get killed for this. I know you said you felt terror, but how aware were you of the huge risks you were undertaking here?
Well, we were aware that the risks were there, but it was clear that the FBI, it was beyond the imagination of the FBI back then, that they would be the target of a burglary. They would do that, of course, to others routinely, but it was beyond their imagination that, in fact, they would be the target of a burglary. And, of course, it was important that night of the 8th that we chose because the FBI office in Media was in an apartment house, and the upper two floors had apartments, and we needed to be sure that those folks were otherwise occupied than listening to what was going on below them. And, in fact, that turned out to be the case. We couldn't know in advance that J. Edgar Hoover would send out, finally, 200 agents to try to find us. They were not successful, obviously. And the reason they weren't successful was we had the best place in the world to hide. There were thousands and thousands of active people against that war in Vietnam here in the city of Philadelphia back then. And so we could disappear as a little fish swimming with a whole school, a huge school of fish in that ocean of anti-war activity. And that was a successful place to hide. The best place to hide is right in plain sight.
You know, Bonnie, I have to ask you this question because I have two little children, and now this question always comes up on my mind for anything I do, because I have to find a babysitter when I ever want to do anything. So you had three children under 10, so you're basically breaking into an FBI office. Did you have to find a babysitter?
We found a babysitter. We were in that part of the city. We had formed a babysitting co-op, so we would request sitters on the nights that we needed them, and I think on that particular night, it was a good friend of mine, and we told her that we would probably not be back until just in time to wake the kids up for school, assuming we didn't get busted.
Assuming you didn't get busted, of course. Now, you both went. I wanted to ask you this for both of you. One of you could have gone, and the other one stayed home in case there was someone arrested, because at least the kids would be with one of their parents. But if you guys got caught, you both would go to prison, and your children would be gone from you. Did you make provisions for that, practical ones?
Yes, we did. I talked to my older brother, and I didn't tell him, of course, what we were doing. I just say there was a risk that we might spend some time in prison. And if that happened, a worst-case scenario, would he take the three kids and help raise them? And he said, yes, he would. This is a question that comes up again and again and has since the story broke on the 7th of January of this year. How could you, parents of three small children, expose them to the kind of danger by taking on the activities that that you did? I think a straightforward answer to that is that when you become parents, you don't stop being citizens. As a matter of fact, out of the legacies you give to your children, you hope you can give them a good education, you get a little bit of money, you hope you give them a good psychological and spiritual foundation. But the greatest legacy you give to your children is the country in which they're going to do their living as adults and raise their children. So when you become parents, the burdens and responsibilities of citizenship, in fact, increase.
You uncovered COINTELPRO's, the program, COINTELPRO by J. Edgar Hoover, which is an illegal spying program on U.S. citizens that broke one of the biggest stories in U.S. history, just as big as probably what Edward Snowden has done and as big as the Pentagon Papers. But when you discovered some of these things, assassinations and things about Martin Luther King, of what they were doing, I'm sure you were excited and knew you wanted to expose it, but there must have been a moment you're like, oh, my God, I'm going to get a bullet in my head for this.
Well, at first, we didn't find COINTELPRO right away. We didn't know. We found a document, and that was at the top of the document, but we didn't know what that was. We did find documents, however, that spoke of the FBI not as an agency of investigating people, but rather an agency that had undertaken activities under J. Edgar Hoover of dispelling and dispensing with dissent, of attacking people who are involved in the anti-war activity, that is, exercising their constitutional rights out of the First and Fourth Amendment. It was only several years later, actually, with the help of an investigative reporter from NBC News, that finally the documents were released under the Freedom of Information Act. That was probably around 1973, and then COINTELPRO and the dirty tricks of J. Edgar Hoover became known. And yes, it did include attempts to blackmail Martin Luther King into committing suicide. It did include information that indicated that the Black Panther Party in Chicago had FBI infiltrator and former inside, and there was a raid and a purposeful assassination of the leader of the Black Panther Party in Chicago. So under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI was involved in a dirty tricks campaign to deny First Amendment rights, that's not only immoral, it's also illegal. That's indictable behavior.
What did it feel like, you two, when the Washington Post article above the fold came out? It must have been amazing.
Well, that was the outcome that we were hoping for, but kind of holding our breath. And it took a few days for that to happen, and so we were rather concerned that nothing much was going to happen.
Well, the burglary took place on the 8th of March, and the publication, the first publication date, was not until the 23rd of March. Mm-hmm. So there were a number of days in there, and those were the days of very, very, those days were a very, very intense FBI agent covering. They were desperately hoping to get those documents back before they ever got out to the press.
Yeah.
And we, of course, were having to take some time to sort those documents and then send them off. Literally, Philadelphia was simply flooded with FBI agents. They were everywhere with their cameras and so on. They had no physical evidence from the robbery itself. That was crucial. All they had, and we didn't know this until years later, they had a policeman's artist sketch of Bonnie that didn't really look very much like Bonnie once we saw it, but we didn't know that until long after the statute of limitations had run out.
You guys, what you did changed a lot of things. COINTELPRO changed FBI policy, what you released. You created systems for major government oversight. Legislation was passed, curtailing surveillance. But you could have spent your whole lives in jail and lost your children over this. How did you deal with the stress?
It was stressful. And then I think every year following that, on March 8th, when we were still sitting in our living room, we would have a little champagne. But then after the statute of limitations expired after 5 years and they closed the case, certainly we were quite relieved after that point in time.
That's Charles Monroe Kane talking with Bonnie and John Raines. They're featured in the new documentary 1971, which is available right now for streaming through June 17th. You'll find a link on our website at ttbook.org. If you like what you heard this hour, why not subscribe to our podcast? Just look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. And while you're there, leave us a review. That helps other people discover the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Craig Ely, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.